Why Niger? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump is still on the defensive about his conversation with the widow of a soldier killed in Niger. But why are U.S. troops there anyway?
The short answer to that question is terrorism. There are a number of Islamic extremist groups that operate in Niger, as well as in almost all of its neighboring countries.
Also, when is it appropriate to question a retired four-star general?
We like to think that the military is apolitical and nonpartisan, but that simply does not apply to the person who is the White House chief of staff.
Plus, how singing helps a crew of firefighters from American Samoa to keep going.
When we're up there, it's just us, and we try and stay together as best we can to keep motivated till we get back home.
That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on a Monday. It is good to have you with us. A couple of weeks ago, most Americans would have had trouble finding Niger on a world map. Then on October 4th, four U.S. Green Berets were killed in a firefight with armed militants there. And now the former French colony in West Africa is very much the focus of American attention. And the question is, what are U.S. troops doing there anyway?
And I would just tell you that in the this specific case, contact was considered unlikely. But there's a reason we have U.S. Army soldiers there and not the Peace Corps, because we carry guns.
Defense Secretary James Mattis there on that October 4th skirmish in Niger. For the record, the Peace Corps left Niger in 2011 because of security concerns. From our perch here, it feels like the U.S. has been getting more deeply involved in West Africa, but mostly out of our field of vision. So what do we know? Let's hear from Laura C. She's a professor at Colby College, where she teaches African politics. First of all, why are there U.S. troops in Niger?
Well, the short answer to that question is terrorism. There are a number of Islamic extremist groups that operate in Niger, as well as in almost all of its neighboring countries. So the United States began expanding its military presence on the African continent under the Bush administration, and this greatly expanded under Obama, under the rubric of the Global War on Terror. And so the deployments to Niger of American forces happened under the Obama administration, starting about 5 years ago. As the best we know, there are about 800 American forces. For the most part, they're working with the Nigerian military on counterterrorism efforts in various parts of the country.
And is it clear who the enemy is among these varied groups of extremists? Is it like an al-Qaeda offshoot or Ansar Dine, something spilling over from Mali, or is it something new altogether?
Well, that very much depends on what day you're talking about and what area you're talking about. There are several of the groups that operate in Mali that do cross the border. The one that's responsible in the ambush, we believe, involves a group called the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. But you also have Boko Haram on the other side of the country in the area where southeastern Niger and northeastern Nigeria meet. So it's quite a melange of groups, if you will, and really the population suffers greatly as a result of this.
And Boko Haram has pledged allegiance to ISIS, or that's the last we heard. So, I mean, this sounds like it's kind of messy everywhere in Niger.
It really is, yeah. Boko Haram so is known as the Western Province of the Islamic State these days, and it really is a bad situation for lots of people, although I think it's important to understand that these conflicts are distinct. What's going on with Boko Haram is not what's going on in the far west of the country where the ambush happened.
So the conflicts are distinct. Is the U.S. military involved in some way in all of them?
One way or another, yes. So most of the involvement of the United States in this is in advisory capacities, sometimes what's called an advise and assist mission, giving advice and assistance to Nigerian troops who are trying to actually do the fighting against these organizations.
Yeah. So who do you see as the U.S. partners in these various fights in Niger?
The primary partner, of course, is the government of Niger and the Nigerian military. But there are a number of regional interests as well as the French international interests. In the fight against Boko Haram, you have the governments of Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In the fight that we're talking about in the West, France plays a major role, as it does in most of its former colonies. France has kind of been the backup support for many Francophone African countries that have very weak militaries.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about. You wrote an article called "This Is Not Trump's Benghazi," which is a narrative some on the left seem to believe. We should recall that Benghazi, Libya, in 2012 was where U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three security personnel at the U.S. consulate there were ambushed and killed. And lawmakers, especially Republicans, grabbed onto Benghazi and used it to go after Hillary Clinton, who was then Secretary of State and then running for president when the ambush happened. So you say the Niger deaths are not like Benghazi. Why?
And I would argue that Benghazi wasn't like Benghazi either. It wasn't like Benghazi was painted. You know, the Republicans had 30-something hearings on it and 13 or 14 investigations, and they never were able to find any evidence of wrongdoing. And I think that what we'll find in the Niger situation is that this was a case of some kind of human error and underestimation of vulnerability. I mean, the sad truth is that in really difficult, dangerous situations, bad things sometimes happen. And given the fact that the United States presence has expanded so much, that these missions are increasingly common, this is a really tragic situation, but it was probably almost inevitable. And I think the American public needs to be prepared for this to happen again in other places where the United States is engaged in the war on terror on the African continent.
Do you think lawmakers in Washington are asking the right questions about Niger right now?
Some of the lawmakers seem to be asking, what are we doing there? So they weren't necessarily performing their oversight roles, but that's a good place to start. The political climate that we're in right now means a lot more of this is about trying to politicize a tragedy and score political points off of it. And I would say that that would be a really missed opportunity, and that I hope that lawmakers will start asking tough questions about how military force and its use is authorized and to what ends. What are we spending money on, and is it really serving our national interests and our national goals?
Laura C. at Colby College, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Clearly, the controversy surrounding the deaths of those four U.S. soldiers in Niger isn't going away, and neither is the dispute between President Trump and Frederica Wilson, a lawmaker who represents the district where one of the soldiers, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, lived. And that dispute got complicated last Friday when White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders responded to a question from CBS reporter Chip Reed. Reed was taking issue with retired General John Kelly's assertion that Representative Wilson took credit for securing federal funding for a project in her district. Here's Sanders.
The money was
secured before
she came into Congress.
If you want to go after General Kelly, that's up to you. But I think that, that if you want to get into a debate with a four-star Marine general, I think that that's something highly inappropriate.
So is it inappropriate to question a general? For some thoughts on that, we turn to historian Andrew Basevich. He was a career officer in the U.S. Army, and he calls Sanders' statement about questioning a general being inappropriate troubling.
It fails to acknowledge that Kelly, first of all, is no longer an active duty officer, but more importantly, I think, has opted to become a political figure. Generally speaking, we like to think that the military is apolitical and nonpartisan, but that description does not apply to the person who is the White House chief of staff.
And what surprises you most about this? Just kind of give us a sense of how big a change this is, at least to your ears.
None of it surprises me because I think it's been a long time coming. There is, I think, widely acknowledged today, a significant gap between the American military and American society. It's a gap that emerged as an unanticipated consequence of moving to the all-volunteer army. But related to that gap, I think, has been a tendency to elevate the status of the military generally, and in particular the status of very senior officers, and put them on some sort of a pedestal as if they are above the rest of us mere citizens. And I think that's what we heard the president's press secretary articulate.
Have you seen this distance between civilians and military in this country exploited in such a way or to a lesser degree in previous administrations?
It certainly existed in earlier administrations, but it's been exacerbated in the present administration. And I think it's been exacerbated in part because of President Trump's unexpected elevation of at least three very senior military officers to policy positions. We've now got Kelly and Mattis and McMaster, who occupy in one way or another policy-making positions.
And yet we're being told that they are now the adults in the room.
I think that's actually a troubling claim. Let me be clear. I think that Kelly, Mattis, and McMaster, all three of them, are intelligent men. I'm sure that they are patriotic, but they also show signs of being exceedingly limited in their intellectual horizons. We have managed to embroil ourselves in a series of foreign policy crises ranging everywhere from the Middle East to North Korea that demand fresh thinking. And we have a president who doesn't do much thinking at all, and he has surrounded himself with a group of people who tend to believe that if a reliance on military force hasn't produced the intended outcome, then the solution is to increase the reliance on military force.
So Sarah Huckabee Sanders' defense of John Kelly came after John Kelly came to the defense of Donald Trump for that conversation in which he was telling a military widow, Maisha Johnson, about her lost husband, LaDavid Johnson, in Niger. I just would like to know what you think is really at stake in this back and forth between Trump and Ms. Johnson. I mean, it's turned into a conversation about privacy, but what do you think it's really about?
Well, I think what it should be about is, why do we have U.S. forces in Niger? Who sent them there? How does the U.S. military presence in Niger relate to some plausible, larger strategy? I mean, as far as I can tell, it's simply a further expansion of U.S. military activities in sub-Saharan Africa, which have generally gone unnoticed by the American public, and that continues to grow like Topsy, regardless of the fact that there's very little evidence that it's achieving anything.
The Washington Post had quoted a White House official saying, "The president's conversations with the families of American heroes who have made the ultimate sacrifice are private." The elements of that sort of phone call are familiar, sadly familiar to you. Some of our listeners will recall that your own son, an Army lieutenant, was killed in Iraq in 2007. Is a president on solid ground if he claims conversations with bereaved families are private?
Well, my personal opinion would be that, yes, they should be considered private. But I must say, no president ever called me and my family at that particular moment. And I would also say that doesn't bother me. I mean, I didn't need to hear from the president of the United States. And had I heard from the president of the United States, it would not in any way have lessened the grief that I was feeling at that time. But at the end of the day, it ought to be the choice of the family that's involved. And I do think that to some degree, what we've allowed to happen here is that the issues that deserve public attention, and that's the trajectory of U.S. military involvement in Africa, that ends up getting shoved aside by the controversy related to the president's phone call. Now, the president brings these problems on himself because we have never had a president whose mastery of the English language is so defective, who is so unable to express himself clearly. And so he creates his own problems, and this is a very good example of that.
At the end of his briefing to the press on Thursday, General Kelly said that he would take questions only from people present who had a personal connection to a fallen soldier. So, sadly, you would have been granted the question. What would yours have been for General Kelly?
I would have wanted General Kelly to explain how the group that killed the American soldiers in Niger posed a threat to the United States of America of such magnitude that it would have led to the loss of our troops.
Historian Andrew Basevich, a career officer in the U.S. Army. His most recent book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. Thanks very much for being on the show again.
Thank you.
That question, when is it appropriate to question a four-star general, it was a perfect one to put to the world's community of U.S. veterans, and a few of them responded by saying that there is one time when it's not appropriate to challenge a military superior, and that's when someone is receiving a direct order during battle. Navy vet Albert Sanchez Alvarez from San Diego made another point. Military members, he wrote, have a duty to question any unlawful orders. In other words, he said, they can't just break the law and later on say that they were just doing what they were told. Sanchez Alvarez added that civilians have a duty to always question authority, and this is something the overwhelming majority of vets expressed. They said people in government need to be questioned and held accountable, even if, like General Kelly, they're former high-ranking officers. Our network of veterans is an important part of our reporting on these issues. If you're a vet and want to help us with our future coverage, join by texting the word RETURN to the number 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. And thanks. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. It's the world. Last summer, the world's Richard Hall spent some time on a boat in the Mediterranean. He wasn't on vacation. He was on the Vos Hestia. It's a boat used by the humanitarian organization Save the Children. Rich was reporting on the group's efforts to rescue migrants from the boats that smugglers ferry them over to Europe on. Today, the Vos Hestia was boarded by police in the southern Italian port of Catania, where it's docked. Rich says the police want to know if the crew of the Vos Hestia actively coordinated its activities with the same smugglers they're supposed to be rescuing people from.
There has so far been no real proof provided. You sometimes get reports in right-wing media or from right-wing activists presenting videos or reports, and what they usually amount to is just a video of smugglers being in the same place as the rescue boats, as the Save the Children boats. A lot of these accusations are based on a misunderstanding of how these boats operate. Save the Children doesn't direct the ship. They lease the ship, which is run by a separate crew. And they are in coordination with the Italian Coast Guard. So they don't choose where to go. The Italian Coast Guard tells them where to go. They say, a ship is over here, it's in trouble. You must go there. They don't sail around looking for ships to rescue. And Save the Children have repeatedly denied being in contact with smugglers.
So what happened today as Italian police continued this investigation on board the ship?
So it's not unusual for the Italian police or the Coast Guard to come onto the boat to have a look around. What was different this time was that they had a search and seizure order. An Italian prosecutor launched a fact-finding investigation into the work of the NGO boats back in February. He was convinced that smugglers were in direct contact with rescuers, although at the time he said he had no proof. And they've been looking into this since then, looking into the collaboration between these NGOs that are trying to rescue migrants in the sea and people smugglers who are making money from doing that. Today's raid actually had nothing to do with the Save the Children staff. I should make that clear. Save the Children released a statement saying that it was to do with a third party. What I think that means is they were investigating either the crew or the safety team on board. And there were reports in the Italian press a few months ago that the captain of the Vos Hestia was under investigation. So again, not to do with the Save the Children staff, which is focused on humanitarian operations when the migrants actually come onto the boat.
There are reports that an undercover police agent spent some time on the Vos Hestia gathering information. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. This is one of the stranger things to come out of this investigation. I was figuring out earlier, this guy must have been on board when I was on the ship, and I have to say I have no clue who it was. But it was reported it was part of the safety team, and it was reported that someone among that team had been providing information to the Italian police. That came out a couple of months ago, which sounds really crazy when you think about it, that the Italian authorities are putting informants on these ships to figure out what's going on, and yet they still haven't produced anything of note.
What effect could this all have on nonprofits like Save the Children continuing their work in the Mediterranean?
So actually, earlier today, a representative of Save the Children Italy announced that they would be suspending their operations. Now, I haven't had that confirmed from the team in London yet, but that would mean that Save the Children are not going to be operating in the Mediterranean. They said that they were tired of being a replacement for a proper European policy. They also mentioned pressure from the Libyan Coast Guard, which has been acting very aggressively towards the NGOs. What we should know, actually, that departures from Libya to Italy have dropped somewhat. So far in October, sea arrivals to Italy are down more than 75% compared to the same month last year. So a combination of all this pressure from the Libyan authorities, the Italian authorities, and the drop in arrivals is going to mean there's far fewer humanitarian operations in the Mediterranean to save lives.
Clearly, it's all something you'll be watching in the days ahead. The world's Rich Hall in Beirut. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
It's an impressive video. You may have even seen it. A group of firefighters marching slowly out of a forest in Northern California, and they're singing. These firefighters from American Samoa are known as a hand crew. They've just gotten back home after battling fires in California, where 42 people have died and many more are still missing. Firefighters from across the U.S. are often sent to remote locations to battle fast-moving fires during peak wildfire season. And American Samoa is a U.S. territory, so they also came to the rescue this time. Anthony Wyberski is a member of American Samoa Squad 61. You guys sound really good. How much do you rehearse?
We hardly rehearse. This is just something that's naturally born within us and something that we do on a daily basis here at home.
Right. You do work as a group, and so I assume that singing probably comes fairly naturally when you do it. Tell us where your squad was deployed in California, how long you were there for.
We took a flight from home all the way to Hawaii, then from Hawaii to Sacramento, and then on a bus, we went to Redding to get our gear. From that point, we go to a camp, and then that's where we start fighting fires.
And you were there for how long?
About 3 months.
Wow. So how did these fires compare to what you usually fight in American Samoa?
That's a funny thing. We don't have no fires here in American Samoa. We have a long-running joke that we are 100% humidity. So when they had the program start up and we joined, we found out, hey, this is exciting work. And we're not just doing this because it's something we like, but it's something that we know we're helping others with.
Right. So as I said earlier, Anthony, you call your squad a hand crew. Can you tell us a little bit about what a hand crew actually does? What role do you play in fighting fires?
Our role as a hand crew is to pretty much go out there and be the muscle. We have a large number of members, so we can split up and we can do different things. You know, if people need us to go here and put in a line around a fire, we'll do that. If we have enough people and they need us to go and set up a water pump, you know, we have people that can go and do that. It varies depending on the level of skill you have. And that's pretty much our job as a hand crew. We do our part to help others do their parts.
And since the hand crew is, as you say, the muscle, what is your training like?
Our training is, I would say, half and half, one side mental and one side physical. Back home, we try and keep up with our physical training. You know, we'll call out the crew and tell them, hey, this is physical training day, you know, get ready. And then sometimes we'll switch it around and, hey, today we're going to do in-house work, showing people, if you're in this kind of situation, how would you get out of it? We want people to think outside of the box so that, you know, no one's tunnel vision on one thing. Safety is a priority, and we want everyone to come back home alive.
So that clip of you and the hand crew singing, it's been making the rounds on the internet. What exactly were you singing?
So that is part of what we call Fa'a Samoa, our Samoan way of life. It's a church song, and it's just one of our motivations to keep going throughout the day. You know, putting smiles on people's faces is something we like to do. You know, we're considered the happy crew. Every day, hiking back to our vehicles, we'll sing a different song. It's what we use to get throughout the day. You know, all of us, we come from different religions and different families, but they're brothers and sisters. You know, it's the way we always been. When we're up there, it's just us, and we try and just stay together as best we can to keep ourselves motivated until we get back home.
Anthony Wyburski is a firefighter with American Samoa Squad 61, the Happy Crew. Check out the full video of them singing at PRI.org. News headlines are next. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. A metal band from the D.C. suburbs recorded a version of the Catalan anthem and put it on the web. They never expected it to go viral, but that was before the independence referendum.
We expected maybe a couple thousand people to see it, not the entire region of Catalonia, so that was a surprise for us.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There are three, count them, three separate investigations on Capitol Hill into Russian meddling in last year's U.S. election and whether Team Trump colluded with Russia in any way. One thing we've learned a lot about in recent weeks are the ways Russian trolls use social media to try to influence the election. A lot of that work was done online, but it turns out some of it was happening in real life, too. That's according to an investigation by the Russian business magazine RBC. It found that the Kremlin-linked Internet Research Agency, which was behind much of the online activity, also contacted dozens of activists in the U.S. and tricked them into sharing content, but also organizing real-life actions and rallies. Micah White was one of those targeted. He was one of the people behind the Occupy Wall Street protests. And in May of last year, he got an email from a man named Yan Big Davis, claiming to be with an organization called Black Matters US.
He got in touch with me through my website, basically saying he wanted to interview me.
On its website, Black Matters US described itself as a nonprofit news outlet, focusing on urgent issues important to the African-American community in America. Michael White didn't question the interview request. He's African-American, a prominent activist. He'd just come out with a new book. And at the time, he didn't know what he knows today, that the organization was being operated by the Internet Research Agency, the Russian Troll Farm. So he agreed to do the interview.
The interview was strange because it sounded like, first of all, that he was calling from a long distance, you know, the call quality was bad, but then also his English was really weird. And I thought at the time, I was like, well, he must be like a black African in America, and that's why he's interested in racism in America. Like, I created this whole like mental justification in my head as to why he was obviously not a native English speaker, American English speaker.
So beyond the interview, what else were your interactions like with Jan Big Davis and quote-unquote, Black Matters U.S.?
He emailed me a couple times after the interview just asking me to promote some protests that they were organizing. But no, I didn't do anything further because I was, you know, I became very, there was just something so weird about the interaction that I just kind of, from that point forward, kept my distance.
There were other activists, though, who did comply with requests made by this fake organization, Black Matters U.S., even organizing rallies. Since you've spent so much of your life in activism, how does it feel knowing that Russian trolls were behind some of these actions, online and offline?
Personally, I think that it's disturbing because I think that it calls into question the legitimacy of American protests. And I think that that could be one of the goals of the Russian trolls, is that from this point forward, I think that people will have to say, like, well, is that a real protest or is that like a Russian-funded protest? And I think that that's a really troubling situation to be in as an American activist, because I think that protest is kind of necessary for human progress and it's necessary for democracy. And I think that by undermining the legitimacy of protest in America, you actually undermine American democracy.
What do you think this is going to do to activism in the United States? I mean, do you have to now turn your focus to vigilance online and not so much issues?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's going to force American activists to be more nuanced in our tactics. Like, I think that one of the interesting takeaways is that Russia was able to create a fake American activist organization that had more likes on Facebook than the actual Black Lives Matter group. I mean, that to me is like, it's stunning, you know? And I think on the one hand, American activists need to change it up. We need to become more unpredictable. And then I think on the other hand, we need to be more aware of the forces that are trying to use us, because I think that obviously Russia was trying to use American activism and that wouldn't have been a positive outcome for us. We would have been pawns in a bigger geopolitical game.
Do you feel like you got used?
No, because I feel like I was like, you know, skeptical enough that I just broke off contact. Had I actually organized protests or promoted the protests, I totally would have felt like I had been used. But I think that, you know, they weren't very sophisticated in this first round. Like, I think that going forward, obviously, if I were Russia, I'd be like, well, why don't we hire native English speakers to do our interviews? You know, like just simple stuff like that going forward. I think they'll get better at it. So, and there might be groups that were undetected. That's the other thing. It's like, we don't know if this was all of the groups or not.
Michael White, co-creator of the Occupy Wall Street protests and the author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. Thanks very much for your time, Micah.
Thank you.
And we're going to stay in Russia for this next story. Last Friday, we devoted the whole show to global reaction to the Harvey Weinstein scandal. One place we didn't hear from, though, Russia. Amy Ferris-Rotman is Foreign Policy Magazine's Moscow correspondent, and she says the reaction to Weinstein there has been pretty surprising.
There's been a resounding feeling of solidarity with Harvey Weinstein, of exoneration of Harvey Weinstein, and of blame of the victims.
Yeah, which is kind of weird because that's almost exactly the opposite of the reaction in other parts of the world. It feels like as more celebrities speak out about their own Weinstein experience, it's given courage and license to other women to talk about theirs, and even more women talking about their own personal experiences of sexual assault, full stop. But have those stories opened the floodgates in Russia for celebrities and public figures there to talk?
Not really. Actually, we're seeing the complete opposite happen. Instead of seeing celebrities come out, women come out and talk about their own experiences of sexual harassment, what we're seeing here is a rather united and vociferous film industry totally against the women in Hollywood who've come out and said that Harvey Weinstein abused them. We're seeing very high-level Russian actresses coming out, blaming the actresses in America outright. We saw the words of one just a few days ago, Agnia Kuznetsova. She's a really famous Russian actress. She's even starred in a film as a rape victim. And she actually came out and said, "I feel sorry for this poor man, Harvey. Women were created for schemes like this."
That's just flabbergasting. So what do you think is going on? Isn't sexual harassment a problem in Russia like everywhere else around the world? And what's keeping women from coming forward?
I think sexual harassment in Russia is not talked about. It's considered something that you need to be ashamed of. It hasn't been fully explored in culture and in society. It's not open yet. So I would say that's behind it. Also, it is a macho culture. Let's not forget. Russia is very macho in its behavior, in its language, and in the way women are treated.
Well, explain this, because Russian lawmakers have already decriminalized some forms of domestic violence, and there is an anti-abortion movement growing in Russia. Do you see connections between all of that and the Weinstein allegations, or in the lack of kind of reaction to them?
Absolutely. Living in Russia, there's definitely a feeling that women have arrived at a moment of shrinking freedoms. And this is coming from all sides, from the rise of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is becoming ever more popular, by the tide of conservatism, which is happening in this country, and by the government itself. President Vladimir Putin decriminalized certain aspects of domestic violence legislation. There is actually no law against it, but there is some existing legislation framework, but he decriminalized it in February. And while women have had the right to abortion for decades and never had the sorts of pressure that American women and clinics have, there is this growing anti-abortion movement here, which is gaining a lot of traction. And I think it's all connected. And I think the Harvey Weinstein scandal kind of turned all of this on its head and presented this opportunity for Russia to look itself in the mirror. While some of the feminists here did do that, there were some voices speaking out, of course, against this. Overall, it was a very strange and I would say quite sad reaction.
You wrote about one Russian TV show host responding to the scads of women making charges about Weinstein, and he wanted to know why they didn't come out earlier and say, "Watch out for him, he's dangerous," or "I'll never work with him." And that suggested to me that, at least as one man, didn't understand the pressure not to talk when a woman is confronted by a man who's got the power to make or break their career. How widespread is that lack of understanding of those power dynamics in Russia? Or do you think this guy is just in denial?
Yeah, I don't know if he's in denial. I think there is a lot of, just as we're seeing unravel in this Harvey Weinstein scandal in the West to do with what it means to be a man in power and what that means for what is kind of expected that he can get away with women, and how we're questioning that now. I think that that's existed in Russia already for some time, as it has elsewhere. And I don't feel Russians kind of want to speak about it. It's almost beneath them to speak about it because they find it so obvious, if that makes any sense. I mean, there's a perfect example yesterday with the head of Russia's only independent radio station, Echo Moskvy, and he Instagrammed a picture of himself with two young ladies and put underneath, "Don't get envious, Harvey." Mm. I mean, I think that's a perfect example of just how numb the reaction has been.
Amy Ferris-Rotman, Moscow correspondent for Foreign Policy. Thank you very much, Amy.
Thanks, Marco.
According to the Department of Homeland Security, more than 600,000 people overstayed their U.S. visas last year. The Trump administration has prioritized finding and deporting people who overstay their visas, but for many of them, overstaying is not the plan. Ashley Cleek has a story of one couple from Colombia.
This is not how Francia and her husband Jorge expected their life to look. Living in a cramped room in New York City with a two-month-old, working round the clock to pay back the money they borrowed to come here.
It
was just not how we had originally planned it or expected it. And we didn't want to become undocumented people here in the U.S.
But they did. Jorge and Francia came to the U.S. from Colombia about a year ago. Their plan was to work, save money, and go to Canada before their six-month tourist visas here expired. But that's not what happened. Jorge and Francia are from Cali, a city in Colombia struggling with violence.
We felt just up to our necks from all this violence. There was always this order and disorder, and we always were somehow close to these situations of violence.
Francia narrowly missed a deadly bombing in a public plaza, apparently linked to clashes between the government and guerrilla groups. Later, Francia says, her husband Jorge was robbed at gunpoint at the internet cafe he owned.
And the man who came and robbed him, he wasn't wearing a mask. You could see his face. So Jorge was scared. If he filed a report, if he denounced what had happened, the man could kill him. He knew where we lived, and so we didn't file a report for fear.
They decided it was time to leave, perhaps to Canada. They could apply to study or work there. But Francia says they hit wall after wall.
No están hecho para personas de clase baja media como nosotros.
The system is just not made for people from middle class like we are. Every time we would try to improve ourselves and do something more, and they would just put more obstacles against us. So we learned English and we became bilingual. But then they said, no, you also need French.
So they went to New York City on a tourist visa and planned to cross into Canada illegally after saving some cash. They figured in Canada, they'd be able to find a way to stay. So they rented a room in New York and found some work. Jorge at a deli, Francia as a maid.
And we knew it wasn't going to be easy. We were ready to do hard work. We were ready to do cleaning or things that were not requiring their education that we have. And we've done it, you know, with love, with patience in our hearts.
Then Francia got pregnant. A welcome surprise, albeit a little early. It meant they wanted to get to Canada and set up life there even faster. Francia found a smuggler online who said he'd take them to Canada, but it would cost them about $1,200. They emptied out their savings to pay. Francia was 6 months pregnant. Jorge quit his job. They packed their things, and the day they were supposed to leave for the border, the smuggler never showed up. Jorge says he called the guy over and over to try and get their money back. Eventually, he gave up.
He knows that we're undocumented, so we could get deported or who knows.
It left Jorge and Francia with no money, no plan, and their U.S. tourist visas were up. They were now undocumented.
In this country, you have opportunities for education, but people who don't have documents, they can't get to those opportunities. And in Colombia, you can have all the documents, but there are no opportunities.
Opportunities is what Jorge and Francia sought out for themselves and for their newborn son, Isaac. During her pregnancy, Francia and Jorge made a book for their son. It's decorated with stickers and says, Te amamos, we love you, on the front. There are pages of letters to little Isaac about how his parents were waiting for his birth.
Happy New Year.
Now that they're a family of three, the pressure is intense. And Francia is terrified of being deported. Since Trump was elected, there have been times when she was afraid to leave the house. That fear convinced the family to try to head for Canada again. And here, Francia wanted to speak in English.
I'm not a paper. I'm a person. I don't want to continue spending my life fighting.
They found someone else who'd take them into Canada. So recently, Francia, Jorge, and little Isaac left New York and are now in Montreal, hoping to find a way to stay there legally. For The World, Ashley Gleick, New York.
Tomorrow, Ashley has a story of a woman from Grenada who escaped an abusive husband by staying in the U.S. with her daughter. But when her visa expired,
a gift was being taken away from me because as long as I had that visa, there was so much I could do, so much. But once that's taken away from me, I felt as though I wasn't a person anymore because I belonged nowhere.
Our story, that's tomorrow here on The World. And we've got just enough time for another quick preview of something else on tomorrow's show. Reporter Rupa Shenoy begins a three-part story from Portland, Oregon. It's a progressive city, not a place where you'd expect a man to harass a black woman wearing hijab or to stab the men who tried to rescue her.
They lost their lives because of me and my friend and the way we looked.
How those murders brought up old concerns of injustice in Portland. That's tomorrow here on the show. Catalonia said it wanted to secede from Spain. Spain said no. 3 weeks ago, Catalans voted to do so. Spain's government in Madrid still said no. And that was all before this weekend when Madrid said it would just begin running the Catalan regional government for the Catalans. To that, Catalans said, no way. The Spanish government continues to insist that the independence referendum was unconstitutional. That does not sit well with Josep Maria Terricabras, who is Catalan and a member of the European Parliament. He takes the long view and says Madrid's threats of a takeover are a throwback to the days of dictator Francisco Franco.
We can expect something like that coming from Franco, but not from a democratic institution. That's so incredible, and I hope that the European and the international institutions protest against that. We will resist.
My BBC colleague Tom Burridge has been speaking with people in Catalonia and beyond.
So Madrid has made its move. But a large part of Catalan society out on the streets tonight, campaigning for independence, will not take it lying down. The key test for the Spanish government will be when it tries to physically take control in the coming days of Catalonia's devolved government. For those out on the streets, peaceful, direct action will be the order of the day.
I feel so sad about this. This is not a democracy. I feel that we are living in a dictatorship.
It's been many years that we tried to talk with the government, but it's like they're only looking for Spain.
What you guys ultimately want still is a recognized referendum, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is Plaza España, Spain Square, in the city of Zaragoza in Aragon. Locals here are enjoying a sun-soaked, long Spanish lunch. In places like this across Spain, there is no shortage of support for the Spanish government's position vis-a-vis Catalonia. People here are willing their government to act. Luis Falcón guides us into his bar full of Spanish police memorabilia. This former Spanish soldier says Madrid should have intervened in Catalonia long ago.
No, nada.
And on the Catalan topic, Berta has it crystal clear. The independence lot are doing what they want, she tells us. But they can't.
No pueden.
Disculpa, buenos días, señores. Sois de aquí?
Then a father and daughter visiting Zaragoza.
De qué parte?
De Barcelona.
Yes, next door in Catalonia. Marie Pilar says she is very Spanish and Catalan. But in her village, it's a divisive topic which many avoid.
Yo vivo en un pueblo muy pequeño. Y no se puede
hablar. Mass inside Zaragoza's vast basilica, a world away from cosmopolitan neighborhoods in Barcelona. Two Spains and people divided about how Catalonia fits in.
The BBC's Tom Burridge reporting. So that rift between Catalonia and the rest of Spain, it's gotten people across the globe waiting to see what's going to happen next. So let's end the show today with the story of some musicians who never expected to get caught up in Catalonia's push for autonomy. They're a heavy metal band from the Washington, D.C. area, seriously, and to understand how they got involved, we have to get into a little bit of recent history. Here's WAMU reporter and former intern here at The World, Michaela Lafrac.
In early October, Catalonians held a vote on independence, and national police cracked down hard. They used rubber bullets and batons to beat back people trying to vote. Nearly 900 people were injured. As the violence unfolded, a woman named Nina Asegueda was watching the news across the Atlantic. She lives in a Virginia suburb of Washington, but her mother's from Catalonia, and many of her relatives still live there. I was just there last year with my husband. We were in Barcelona and visited my uncles and all of my cousins.
She wanted to show her support for her family, and she had an idea. She's the lead singer of an independent heavy metal band called A Sound of Thunder. They'd recently recorded a version of the Catalonian anthem, and 2 days after the independence vote, they decided to post their song on YouTube. It's a headbanger, to say the least.
We don't have a huge international following. We don't have a huge national following. We expected maybe a couple thousand people to see it.
But way more people than that took notice. The song took off, and within 2 weeks, it had over 1 million hits. Some people even wrote her to say the song made them cry.
As a metal band, you know, we usually don't have this huge emotional impact on people. So for people to say that it brought them to tears, it was very surprising.
The anthem is based off a traditional Catalonian song that dates back to the 1600s. Osegueda came across it when she was looking for a song to record in honor of her mother.
And it's actually called The Reapers in English, which is pretty metal. And then we looked at the lyrics and we were like, oh, this is pretty metal.
The lyrics tell the story of the Reapers' War, when Catalonian farmers rose up against the Spanish monarchy. They used sickles as weapons, which became the symbol for Catalonia. Osegueda says it is a fight song, but her band doesn't support actual violence in any way.
The whole violence in the song is more, I would say, a metaphor than anything real. But for us, as a heavy metal band, it always speaks to us.
And it turned out to be pretty easy to turn the original into a metal song.
It has a lot of dissonant chords, and it sounds very doom metal. So we added a gallop and made it more power metal. But it's a pretty metal song on its own.
In the song, Osegueda sings in both English and Catalan, which she says was a little intimidating. Of course, her family in Catalonia is fluent, but she isn't.
As soon as we released the song, I was like, oh boy, I'm kind of worried that I might have messed up the pronunciation. But all of the comments were very kind. People said that, you know, I did a good job, you know, way to go, thank you for trying.
And she's going to keep trying. She and her band dream of touring in Europe now, including a stop in Catalonia. For The World, Michaela Lafrac, Washington, D.C.
Hey, Jimi Hendrix can do it. That'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
PRI. Public Radio International.